Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Big Questions with Big John. I'm your host, Big John. And today we have someone very interesting to talk to, a lot of great topics we could get into. But first, before I do any of that, let me read a short introduction bio of my guest. My guest today is a prominent figure in the Liberty Movement. He has served as the president of the Young Americans for Liberty, where he played a pivotal role in expanding that organization's reach across college campuses nationwide. His leadership was instrumental in mobilizing young Liberty activists committed to advancing the principles of Liberty. Currently, this gentleman, my guest, is the CEO of the Pennsylvania Chase, where he continues to apply his expertise in political strategy and grassroots mobilization. Join us as we delve into his insights and experiences in championing freedom and political engagement, especially among the young. Everyone, please welcome Cliff Maloney Jr. to the show. Cliff, how you doing today?
I'm great, John. We're in the thick of it right now. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, man. Glad you found some time. I know you've got a busy schedule. Really appreciate you. And from a key battleground state like Pennsylvania, definitely we can get some insights. But before we get into what's going on in this political cycle, this election cycle, I just want to start out, ask you a little bit about your past, how you got involved in politics. So first of all, where did you grow up? Was it in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I grew up in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. So I spent first 18 years of my life there. I went to school in Johnstown, PA. So the next 4 years I spent out there. So I spent a lot of time on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, crisscrossing the state. But my entire family is in southeastern PA.
Okay, so you're a Pennsylvania man through and through. Did you end up going to college, or did you start your activism straight out of high school?
Yeah, so I went to school. I got a degree to teach math. So I was a certified teacher in Pennsylvania. But while I was in college, I found a video of Ron Paul, the crazy old doctor from Texas, talking about the wars, talking about the Fed and inflation. A man in my mind who was ahead of his time. And so that really, you know, that intrigued me. It got me involved. I helped on his presidential race in 2012 as a volunteer. I ended up getting an internship and a staff position working in his congressional office, which is separate from the presidential. But that was kind of my first jump in. But it wasn't until, you know, 2014, I did my student teaching. And I realized if I wanted to advance liberty and restore the Constitution, being a fifth grade public school math teacher was probably not the way I was going to do it. And so after 2014, I put a hold on teaching and jumped into the political world. And it's been a wild ride these last 10 years.
Yeah, that is an interesting transition from a math teacher to politics. I'm trying to think if there's a natural sort of connection there. I the ancient Greeks used to say that math was the purest form of logic, right? And the purest form of thought, you know, and their political views, I think, although they certainly don't match up with a liberty perspective, but it'd be interesting to see if there's a commonality of thought processes between math and politics. Would you say that there is or is not?
Well, I think what originally got me involved was the economics, you know, where there is some math and understanding free market or Austrian economics,
right?
Compared to a lot of the Keynesian kind of big government, you know, debt is good mentality of the corrupt DC uniparty. So I think that's probably what drove me to it. But then I think Ron's consistency and this idea of, you know, should the government really be involved in so many pieces of our lives? It was the debt, it was the inflation, it was the Fed. Those were the things that got me intrigued. And I think from there, I started to understand, you know, the left's ability to mobilize. And I think I looked at, you know, what is the best use of dollars spent to target voters? And the more I did the research, the more I looked at the numbers. So once again, the math, it was kind of obvious to me, you know, the left has spent the last 40 to 50 years doing grassroots community organizing, door to door, and having that direct connection to voters. And the right, you know, to be honest, we've kind of phoned it in on that. And so, you know, since I've gotten involved, that's been my shtick is how do you recruit young people? How do you go door to door? How do you match the left's tactics at building a bench, building a farm team? And over the last 10 years, I've been involved with different organizations, different PACs, different campaigns to try to hit that mission and try to succeed.
Yeah, you know, and just the way you've in hearing you talk, there's a lot of interesting questions and juxtapositions that are floating around my mind right now. So if you don't mind, I'd like to explore them a little bit. First of all, being a you mentioned the Ron Paul revolution, the influence he had in getting you started on this like political activist path that you find yourself on to this day, which is interesting because obviously I'm at least a generation ahead of you, if not a generation or two generations ahead of you. And I always like as I interview some folks in the political sphere, I always find that interesting. Like as a libertarian myself, well, let me ask you this: do you consider yourself a libertarian, a Republican, a conservative, a conservatarian, an anarchist? How would you like? And I know it's always fraught with danger to just apply a label to yourself, but for purposes of easy reference, just to get a general concept, how would you describe yourself politically?
Yeah, I would call myself a philosophical libertarian. I obviously work within the Republican Party. Right. I think politically that's the path to be. But I mean, the joke is I spent all of my time fighting for and against Republicans, right? The Republican rhinos, I have no interest in protecting. I have no interest in dealing with their stuff. Just this past primary, I took out two Republican rhinos in PA in state house races. Okay. You know, we'll talk about some of that work that we're doing. But yeah, I think obviously the principles of liberty, you know, I think libertarianism, the problem you run into is people associate that with the party. And my objective is to win. And I don't mean win by compromise, but I like to use any party I can use as a vehicle to advance freedom. And right now it's very clear that if you want to win and you want to advance the cause, you need to do that under the Republican banner.
Which is interesting because obviously that's a tack that, say, Ron Paul obviously took, largely working within the Republican Party. And I think most of us who are old enough to remember probably could remember a time where what you're saying was an effective strategy, right? Going back, say, to Goldwater, not that Goldwater was the perfect model of a libertarian, but probably the most libertarian, say, to run for president. You know, he was certainly anti-war at a time when it wasn't popular in the 60s. And but there is that clash because, like, for libertarians of your generation, I know Ron Paul is the man, obviously. Libertarians of my generation, I always say I'm not a Ron Paul guy, not that I have anything against him, but my entree was Milton Friedman. So it was like a different sort of perspective for me, what got me on the libertarian path, the liberty path, right? So one of the interesting questions here is the like, because to old guys like me, the involvement of a lot of today's libertarians, especially those who call themselves anarchists or ANCAPs, a lot of the Free State Project people, obviously, we could talk about that separately, do seem to agree with you that this path is in the Republican Party. But let me ask you about the inherent conflicts there, though. Like, so do you view your mission as sort of like not, I don't want to use the word infiltrate because you're very open about what you see as your most productive strategy for liberty. But is your goal to like get into the Republican Party and turn it to a better version of the Libertarian Party, so to speak, politically? Or is your goal to eventually get to the point where parties don't exist? I mean, I understand that probably won't happen in our lifetimes. But, like, what's the end game of this current strategy you're on? Because I could, like, if I was to play devil's advocate with you, Cliff, I'd say, like, why are we supporting somebody who's anti-free trade? Why are we supporting someone who comes off very much as an authoritarian in his nature? Is it a lesser of two evils deal? Is it a let's get in, then we get rid of those types of Republicans as well as the rhinos? Like, tell me what your vision for the end of your strategy is in your perfect world.
Yeah, let me answer the lesser of two evils question, then I'll talk about overall strategy. So, look, for years I've been the guy, you know, don't vote for the lesser of two evils. But I think if you're a right-leaning free market libertarian, my argument for this being the time when it does make sense is pretty simple. They're trying to chop off the private parts of young children. They believe that the government can be weaponized to go after political opponents and political candidates. And I feel like the deep state and the Uniparty, if there's ever been a time that it's like there's clearly a side against those forces, it's now. You know, you have Tulsi Gabbard, you have RFK Jr. lining up with Tucker, with Trump. That is a type of coalition that I want to be a part of. And I think if you're an ANCAP, I think if you're libertarian, I think if you're a constitutionalist, if you're anything that deals with free markets, I think this is the time. I mean, it's the reason why I'm all in. You know, I've always done state races. And so I just tell people, if there's ever a time that things may have changed to start voting in one of the big parties, this is it. And I'm putting all my energy towards it. So let me take a step back, John, and tell you,
sure.
My mission, you know, we have this program called the PHAs, but the organization that we have that runs it is called Citizens Alliance. And so in 2021, I launched this new organization, Citizens Alliance, and we're active in four states, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Idaho, and North Dakota. Now, you might say that's a pretty random grouping, but there's reasons for each of them. But really what we're trying to do, if you want to know what makes me jump out of bed in the morning,
sure.
is we're trying to create a liberty state. Okay. And so we have these four states as our targets. And at the end of the day, what's my mission? What am I trying to accomplish, you know, 6, 7, 8 years from now? Is I want to create one state where we abolish the income tax, eradicate property tax, cut government spending by 25%, and create an environment that protects civil liberties, protects free speech, protects the Second Amendment, but really just protects states' rights in a way that it's an example for other states to follow. So businesses flock there, quality of life goes up, and we can show, listen, these principles of liberty, they work. And here's your example. And so those are the four states I target. Now, the problem I ran into in Pennsylvania in 2022 is the Republican Party under Ronna McDaniel was so inept, so corrupt, and just completely lack of any strategy that we decided we had to step up. And you pair that with what I said earlier, which is that, you know, it's clearly a race between the establishment and anti-establishment, between the woke, corrupt actors of DC and we, the people, that it all has synergy for me. And so we own this ballot chase operation in PA because the Republicans refuse to participate. And if we do that, look, imagine you're me. You get a bunch of Liberty folks across the finish line in 2022 in PA, right? We're talking R plus 10 districts. We take out a Rhino, replace him with a Ron Paul or a Milton Friedman. I'll start referencing him for you.
Thank you.
And all of a sudden you get to the general election.
Yeah.
And you only win by a couple points in a district you're supposed to dominate in because the party has failed you up ticket. And so this is us, you know, we're reacting. We're playing self-defense to protect our liberty folks. We have about 30 out of the 203 in the state house in Pennsylvania that are super strong. And so that's what I'm trying to do. The PA chase is a way for us to defend those liberty folks. Yes, it's going to help Trump statewide. It'll help all the statewide candidates. But at the end of the day, I'm playing defense. And it's created this nice synergy, but that doesn't mean I'm not afraid to tell you, I am supporting Donald Trump, right? And I get these questions off the cliff. You know, you're this hardcore liberty guy. You know, now you're playing for Team Red. I'm like, listen, they're cutting off our kids' private parts. Like, this is a war, and the left libertarians disagree with me. I mean, Chase Oliver is wrong on all the key issues. He thinks a five-year-old should be able to have sex changes. He thinks that you should be able to read and talk about gender to kids that are 6 years old in the classroom. Like that is not the libertarianism I align with. So it's not even like there's an alternative at the LP that represents a protest vote. No, I mean, RFK, to be honest with you, I understood that people wanted to vote for him. Even he's seen the light and said, look, we got to go to war against the deep state. And so that's my mission. That's why I'm all in on Trump. I totally understand Big John on the devil's advocate, but I've thought through those things. And at the end of the day, I think we lose this election. You know, I used to hate when people would say it's the most important election of our lifetime. But right. I really think this could be a catastrophic moment for the country if she wins. But I also think, I hope you'll respect this, we're going to have to hold the Trump administration accountable, right? We're going to have to go to war, go to battle to make sure we actually cut spending, that we actually cut regulation, that we don't start new wars. So the first step is winning, then comes accountability.
Yeah, I mean, I respect what you're saying because I, you know, that's been like for any third party, for any minority political movement, for any fringe political movement, that's always the philosophical challenge, right? That's the philosophical conundrum you run into, right? Now, everyone seems to have their personal line as to how much compromise is enough and how much is too much, right? Now, I've been very clear about my political thing, right? I'd rather stay home than pull the lever for either Harris or Trump, okay? So that's my perspective, because I think either one of them is too much. If you'll allow me the experience of my advanced age, it's always been the most important election in history. It always seems, I'm not questioning your integrity, Cliff, but it always seems like it comes down to the lesser of two evils argument on some level. I also further agree that my particular outlook doesn't yield victory. So I get what you're saying. And it's, to me, it's a matter of that personal line of how much is too much in terms of, you know, like, was Gary Johnson a line too far? If you were an LP guy, to me, in my mind, probably not. Was William Waldo a bridge too far? Yes, absolutely. You know, and now why? That's just my assessment. You could easily make an argument, a cogent argument, to say both those guys were a bridge too far for the Libertarian Party. Same thing with certain Republicans. I'm sure you feel the same way. So it does sound like you consider yourself a little bit like a small L Libertarian right now and a big R Republican as a means to an end, correct? Is that a good summation?
Yeah, but I don't like big R, because at the end of the day, I think I go to war against the Republican establishment 7 days a week. So, you know, now I'm on Team Red because it's the general, but you can count on one hand how many people are going to war with significant right. resources in the primary. You know, so we're wearing a couple hats, but yeah, I think yes, I am all in for Trump. I am proud to say that. I probably wouldn't have thought I would have said that to you 15 years ago. Sure. But yeah, that's my opinion. I totally respect yours. And my opinion is that this is a time for us to, you know, link forces and to make sure we stop somebody like a Kamala Harris. But then again, if you're somebody that's I've got a lot of friends who just want it to burn. So, you know, in their mind, this is just showing how far we've come, that enough voters are even considering voting for a woman that has no policy positions, really no ability to speak and have any type of message. Right. And this is a real race, John. This is not anybody that thinks that Trump is going to walk with this. I mean, I'd like to see that, but this is a real race. She has a potential to be the next president of the United States.
Oh, I agree.
A lot of people.
Yeah, I agree with you on that point, that without a doubt, I don't think this is in the bag for Trump without even yielding to any sort of voter fraud or anything like that in particular. I just think if you look at some of the like more serious polling, it really is a toss up. It could go either way. So unless there's some sort of surprise on either side, you know, my partner here at Grumblings Media is a dyed in the wool conservative, you know, you know, which FYI, I'm sure he would love to have you on his live stream podcast. You seem like his type, because he's also always complaining about how the Republican Party has failed the grassroots, and how the Republican Party doesn't knock on enough doors, doesn't reach out to the minority communities, especially. So I understand that part of it. And but you're absolutely right. I think it's a 50-50 right now. It's everything's within the margin of any polling error. You know, except for the really partisan hacks on either side of the polling. So I agree with you. It's, if you're a Trump supporter, it is by no means in the bag. It is by no means in the bag. And if you're a Trump supporter, you definitely should go out and make sure you continue the thing. Just to focus a little bit, though, because I always find the Free State Project super interesting to me. I use the term Free State Project. I know that's specific to the New Hampshire guys, but it's the same concept as what you mentioned about, what was it, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, North Dakota, and Idaho or Iowa? Mm-hmm. Which one?
Idaho.
Okay, so make sure I got that right. Okay. Do you feel that any type of that type of Free State Project as a general term, do you feel something like that is achievable strictly through migration and political means, or do you feel that at some point there has to be either a secession of some sort, be it peaceful or violent? Do you feel there has to be some sort of secession from the U.S. in order for a free state project to truly execute your vision of becoming a beacon? You know, like a lot of people with, you know, when Hong Kong, like, for example, became that center of free trade and pretty much sort of a libertarian place to go back in the day. So do you feel that can be achieved solely through political means and migration?
Well, I told you I'm a math guy, so I'll give you the formula. It's very simple.
Absolutely.
For us.
So am I. Go ahead. Hit me.
So we have a Liberty Pledge that we run in each of our states. So we ask candidates to sign a Liberty Pledge, and then we hold them accountable to that. It's a Citizens Alliance, you know, pledge based on the state constitution and the U.S. Constitution. It's hilarious when people give you excuses to not sign it. I mean, it's literally the two documents they take an oath to. But we're able to use that to be consistent and hold them accountable. So here's the map. For us to create what we call a Liberty State, we need 25% of the state house to be pledge signers in good standing. We need 25% of the state Senate to be pledge signers in good standing. And we need a Liberty governor. That's my equation. Now, people can disagree. Some people say it could be lower. Some people say you need more than that. But what I have found is if you have 25% of the legislature in both chambers that are very much aligned with you, right? I'm not talking about good votes here and there. I'm saying they're in good standing. They've signed your pledge. You can get some amazing things done. I mean, you look at New Hampshire, we've got over 25% in the state house. We've got over 100 libertarians elected in the state of New Hampshire. They might be running as Republicans, but they're elected and they're serving and they believe in the philosophy of libertarianism.
Sure.
That's why New Hampshire has put out some of the most free market budgets in the history of New England. Right? It's not because there's just, you know, some random chance. It's like, no. So we have over 25% in the state house there. Idaho, this general election, we have a chance to have over 25% in the state Senate. But that's my equation. And the toughest piece is going to be the final step, checking that third box, which is a Liberty governor.
Correct.
And you know, that's where you have to have real money, you know, and it depends on the state. In Idaho, if you spend $1 million, you can run a competitive governor race. You spend $1 million in Pennsylvania, you're not even going to get 2%.
Right.
I mean, it's going to be, you know, $30, $40, $50 million races. So obviously the state you're in will dictate some of that. But that's my equation. That's my formula. 25% of the House, 25% of the Senate, a Liberty governor. And that's what we're working to. Every morning I've got three boxes to check in all of my four states. And I want one state to go green on all three. And that's when I think we can actually achieve what we're trying to do. We'll take the small wins along the way.
Right. Yes.
But that's how you get to where we have critical mass to bring about real change and real reform.
If you don't mind my asking, because by profession, I'm a data scientist, so I could talk math with you all day. But let me ask you this. How did you arrive at that 25? Not, I don't need specific formulas, but is 25, people say like, hey, Cliff, 25% is still the minority, right? Do you say 25% in each chamber? The Liberty Governor piece, I think that's fairly obvious and self-evident, but I'm saying the 25% in each state chamber, are you saying that's enough as a leverage block to influence other legislation? Is that why you chose 25%? It's like a really powerful, like say in a European parliamentary type of situation, it's really a block that could hold significant power to influence through cutting deals with, say, the two other major parties.
Yeah, well, I think what happens is, once again, I'm not talking about 25% Republican, right? A lot of partisans will jump.
Right, just Liberty people, right?
Right.
Liberty people.
People that are hardcore with us on the ideas. The reason we went with 25 is we found in most states, if you control a fourth of the legislature, you're going to control the whole legislature, right? Because if you have a fourth of the legislature, you're pretty much going to be able to control the majority party voting for who the speaker is and who the majority leader is. In New Hampshire, the speaker and majority leader are huge allies of ours. In Idaho, it's about to be the case in the Senate. If you look at Pennsylvania, the Republicans are in the minority, right? So we don't have our critical mass there yet. We're not even close to 25%, to be frank with you. We're at like 8%. So we've got a lot of work to do. But, you know, once you're in the majority party, if you have 25%, I mean, if it's an 80-20 Republican to Democrat chamber, then 25% is probably not enough. But we find that if you have 25% that are a lock and they're going to vote as a block, you're going to be able to have significant power over not just votes, but controlling the chamber in terms of what legislation is heard, what is blocked, et cetera.
Right. And like, just out of curiosity, do you guys do some sort of rating similar to the ACU or something like that, where you could say like, hey, this guy has a Liberty rating of, you know, 0 to 100, 100 being 100% aligned with liberty ideals. Like, do you guys publish something like that as a matter of reference, or is that something you're working towards just for people like me that can go to your website and actually find something like that and say, hey, I think I can align with so-and-so?
Yeah, so I represent Citizens Alliance of America, but we do have a specific state chapter in each of those four states. So if people are looking for the websites, each chapter, Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, Citizens Alliance of New Hampshire, Citizens Alliance of North Dakota, and Citizens Alliance of Idaho, they're all going to have their own websites because we try to keep it local, and we do. We have a local that runs the state chapters, but each of them, John, has what we call standings. And those standings are simple. We don't put out scores. They're either in good standing, questionable, or bad. And obviously, we're scoring all the votes to come up with what that threshold is. But what we do that's kind of fascinating, and anybody that's ever trying to start any type of political group, I really recommend this. You know, you have to back up what you're doing with pain and praise. I mean that figuratively. We call it political pain and political praise.
Sure.
But pretty much a lot of groups, what they'll do is they'll just spend money around the election. And they're competing with other groups. They're competing with the candidate. And everybody's spending and trying to get a message out. And these are state house races, which the name ID is very low. People are not familiar. You're competing with all these big federal races and national elections. Right. What we do is we have what we call 365. So we do pain and praise all year, even in the off years. And so what you're doing is you are able to set up different individuals that are complete rhinos or sellouts, or a Democrat that's horrible, where you have a candidate you're planning on running, and you can start educating and talking to the voter, right? You can start spreading the word about how bad this person is and just exposing them, just telling the truth. Right. And what happens is we can use that as a weapon. We can weaponize it. You know, if it's like, hey, listen, we know a budget vote's coming up, we can be clear and say, listen, Citizens Alliance, if people vote wrong on this and they join the Democrats to sell us out and raise taxes and raise spending again, we're going to do a mailer to any Republican's district that votes wrong. Hmm. Right. And you got to be careful how you say it. You know, you can't threaten, you can't bribe, but like, we can make it public that we're going to educate people on this vote. And I think, you know, you'd laugh, but like, even in Pennsylvania, we've got a lot of Republican senators who, you know, a couple years ago, they wouldn't vote for one of these huge cronyism boondoggles. And the quote we got from the floor was, I can't vote for this, because CAP, Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, would go to war. And to me, it's like, and we blocked it because of that. And that's like a $5 billion, you know, government expenditure that's now not there. So I don't want to say fear is everything, but being willing to raise the money and spend it in their district, not during the election, has been a great tactic.
Well, it certainly does. It's a behavioral principle, right? Like, you know, if you're into any sort of behavioral therapies, or if you've studied, or you know, like, whether it was Lovaas or somebody like that, you know, like, they would always, or Skinner, what's the best way to change a behavior that you want to see eradicated? It's identifying the antecedent, and then immediately after the behavior, providing praise or criticism, right? That is the best way to change a behavior. If you criticize my behavior a year from now, I'm never going to change that behavior because it has no immediate consequences to me. So the tactic that you use, that it's not just around election time, but like, hey, 365, every day we're going to be, if we see you not aligning with your pledge, if we see you falling out of our ideals of the people that helped put you in your position of power, absolutely, we're going to work against you. I get that. I respect that. And I think it's actually probably the best effective, most effective way of doing it. Let me ask you this. When I hear, when I talk to people about the Free State Project, just everyday people, you know, who are sort of aligned with this, and obviously the Free State Project concept most closely aligns with New Hampshire, and you know, some of the folks in New Hampshire who within the Libertarian Party, outside of the Libertarian Party, dabbling in state politics and stuff. Listen, a lot of their rhetoric is very harsh, and a lot of their rhetoric, I mean, you made the very clear distinction: we're not physically threatening anybody. We're not, you know, but we're not. What I got from you is like, we're hardcore political people, but you know, we're not threatening anybody. Whereas in some of these, especially coming out in New Hampshire, there's a lot of rhetoric where you see things like, if you disagree with these Democratic state senators, spit at them, yell at them, follow them until they leave the state. You know, you get these types of admonitions from, and again, I'm not naming anybody specifically, but I think you and I both know who we're talking about, who I'm talking about, I should say. Do you, I'll give you the opportunity to say, do you or do you not agree with that sort of messaging and tactic? And then based on your answer, we could, I could ask you a follow-up.
Yeah. Well, I think there's always a place for, you know, what's the word I'm looking for people to, you know, kind of flash or grab attention, maybe sensationalism, but I don't think we're at a point where violence makes sense. You know, if people are joking or it's satire, that's very different. But I do think, you know, I mean, listen, I don't think it's crazy to say that we're going to be at that point in the next 4 to 5 years. I hope I'm wrong. I truly believe at a certain point you are going to see, whether it's secession, I'm not pulling for it, but I think at a certain point the federal government's going to become too big. I think the moment happens when California, Illinois, or New York need a bailout, and you're telling a, you know, country music loving 22-year-old from Alabama who's got, you know, 40 guns, that he's got to bail out Gavin Newsom and their degenerate elites who are, you know, drunk on power spending money. I think that's when you start to get into some issues. But no, I don't think violence is the answer. I do think at a certain point that could change. But I think now we have a system. The system is not working well. Some would argue it has failed, but I don't think it's failed yet. But I think we're on the path to that. I mean, the fact that Trump has been targeted, the fact that, you know, not just with assassination attempts, but in the courtroom, I just think that the rhetoric, and I hate when they say, you know, they're turning up the heat, you need to tone it down. But that is the rhetoric now, right? Is, you know, you have to do certain things to save democracy. I think they're kind of out of ideas. And now it's just based on the idea of, you know, using these random rhetoric and talking points. But no, I don't think we're at a spot for violence yet. But I do think that things are escalating at a rapid pace. And eventually you're just going to see some of these states that just the culture is very different. I do think that. I think in some areas, a 22-year-old man using a girl's bathroom is reason for somebody to pull out a gun and blow that guy's brains off because he's deranged. And in other states, it's celebrated. I don't know how you come to a resolution on that. And I think as those things really build, you know, some of it is overanalyzed and it's really just people, you know, wanting headlines. But I do think there'll come a cultural point where it's like, where do we make amends? And I don't know as a country if we'll be able to.
Make amends? Can you explain that a little bit? Make amends to who?
I just think, you know, those types of cultural differences, I don't know how you come to some agreement or some compromise.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Because one side is saying, this is wrong. And the other side isn't saying, oh, no, it's fine. They're celebrating it, right? I mean, you have a lot of these just cultural battles where it's almost celebrated to have men in girls' sports, which to me is very weird, right? It'd be different if you're like, well, there's a discussion to be made. They identify as a girl. It's like, no, they are celebrating it and ripping apart girls' sports, you know, the girls' bathroom thing. It's kind of creepy. It's kind of weird how much the other side, you know, opposite me, is so all in on this. So I don't know. I think it's the same thing with schooling. I think schooling is going to get to a point where the separation of government and education, I don't think there's a resolution ever, because too many teachers, it's too transparent now, and they're activists. And I'm not just saying on the left. I do think it's on the left. But I think if it was on the right and people were in there teaching about, you know, the Bible and teaching about conservative principles, I just think enough parents are going to get to a point where it's like, there's no resolution. It's just, we don't want the government to do this because then there's got to be some sort of generic standard. That's just my opinion.
No, no. And absolutely respect your opinion. And obviously want, that's why we're here. I want to hear your opinion and understand what you're saying. You know, it's, and I really don't want to come off like the doddering old fool who says, ah, we've seen this before, you know, but to some extent we have, right. And like part of, and again, I could be wrong maybe in terms of the way I view the magnitude of what you're talking about. But I'm, and to be honest with you, Cliff, I'm still trying to iron out in my head whether we've always had these sharp differences culturally in this country. Because look, I'm a New Yorker, grew up in New York City, right? So the height of everything, I'm sure that is the antithesis of what you're talking about. And I grew up as a libertarian, initially as a conservative. So I was always like swimming upstream here in New York, right? But I always remember that there was always like a very, very, very defined cultural differences between, say, my family living in New York and my family living in Texas, or my family living in might have been Iowa, you know, like we had family dispersed around the country. And it's like same ethnic background, same religious background, but culturally totally different, right? I don't remember it being as magnified as it is now, but I'm struggling if that's due to the advent of social media, where everybody now feels the need to get on social media, proclaim their beliefs. I'm not blaming anyone. I think that's a natural course of human evolution as technology advances, right? Do you feel like maybe that is part of it as well? We're all more aware of our cultural differences now, and then we have this inherent need to like pound our chests for tribalism and say like, hey, my way is best. I'm going to tell you why it's best. Whereas before, hey, if you were a Bohemian, you moved to Greenwich Village in New York, no matter where you were, right? And if I was tired of the rat race on Wall Street, I would travel north to Connecticut or New Hampshire, or, you know, something like that, or you know, or go out west to Denver or something, right? Colorado. So I think that cultural sort of these cultural bright lines always existed. I'm just not, I'll be honest with you, Cliff. I haven't figured out if people are just now more naturally combative based on the influence of these cultural divides, or if it's a magnification, which is, as we know, social media is all about amplification, right? Or is it due to social media that you now see these more passionate divides over culture? What do you think?
I think alternative media has really, really, I mean, one, I hope it destroys legacy media. I mean, I think shows like yours, you look at all these different, you know, abilities to get directly to the people,
right?
Firsthand knowledge. And I think it's one of the most beautiful things that's happened, not just for the sake of free speech, but for dispersing information.
Sure.
To answer your question directly, I don't think people want to put up with it. And what I mean by that is you might be right. Like maybe it's not that much more than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. But I do think people are much more knowledgeable about it, right? Because of that
yes.
ability
yeah,
to
absolutely.
Have that information dispersed. And I think because they're so knowledgeable, I just think people are fed up. And I don't. I think COVID with the schools just really opened people up to, well, what are you teaching my kids? And look, that could be a derelict of parenting, right? For a couple of generations. I'm not blaming just the school system.
Right.
But I think it's a mix of both, right? I don't think it has 10x'd in terms of the partisanship or the, hey, I'm right, you're wrong, and I'm going to cancel you, or we're going to own you, and you better get in line on both sides. But I just think that the knowledge has been so much more easy to access. I think things are just there for people to take in. And I think that's why you found that, you know, there's a lot more rhetoric, but it's because it's getting to the people. It's not just Walter Cronkite at night telling you the news. Everybody's got different hosts like yourself that they trust to get their news from. And, you know, there's different pieces. And I mean, the thing I'm most excited about, listen, I've done plenty of legacy media, right? I've done political commentating. I mean, I'm still doing it. And it's so much better to do long form shows like this where I can talk and go in depth on an issue rather than 4.5 minutes on corporate media where I get, you know, my 90 seconds, 3 30-second responses. I just think people want that deeper conversation. And with that deeper conversation, John, comes people more heated, more emotional. But yes, just I think they're more aware of what's going on and it's tapping into something, whether it was the same 30 years ago and we just didn't tap into it or not. I don't know. But I think people are probably more offended because they're realizing just how deep the opposite side's views are, or how much, I won't say deep, but how passionate the other side is. And I say that for both ways, right? The left sees the right.
Sure.
And it's like, man, I used to think that they just were, you know, Bible thumpers, but they actually think a woman shouldn't have the right to choose. You know, that's horrendous. That's misogynist. And people on the right are like, holy cow, they actually are okay with chopping a 5-year-old's penis off. That's pretty wild. I just thought they use that as a talk. it's much more in depth. And I think that scares people, and that fear brings the energy up in the room for everybody.
Yeah, I largely agree with what you just said, Cliff. I really do. I'm not looking to poke holes in your argument, because I don't think there are holes to poke in there. I think you're right. I guess just in my mind, for example, I was still in high school when the AIDS epidemic broke out. And obviously at that particular inflection point, late 70s, early 80s, it became obviously a political issue, but culturally you would hear people what was happening, right? So like folks from the Midwest would say, well, that's what happens when you go to New York, where they don't mind if you're gay. And they've got a whole little town called Greenwich Village where all the gays get together. And of course, this is God's vengeance and blah, 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 blah. You still had that sharp cultural divide, right? And it's like, oh, those Bible thumpers in the middle of the country somewhere, they don't understand what's going on, and they want everybody to live exactly the way that, you heard it from both sides. But I don't know that there was that much hatred. Do you know what I mean? I don't know how else to describe it. And it is largely a first-person perspective. Obviously, I can't speak for other people at that time. But largely, some in New York didn't give a rat's ass about what somebody in Chicago did, and didn't care what somebody in California did, Texas, Minnesota. Nobody cared, right? Unless you were in that state, nobody really cared. And that had to do a lot with the media being localized. Like you mentioned Walter Cronkite, right? Guy was basically a communist. We all kind of know that. We all understand the leftist bias of the media back then. But the stuff that really inflamed people to the point that it's inflaming now was not localized, right? And to your point, that's social media. That's long-form content. And let's face it, there's a lot of unvetted stuff that goes, like you and I right. may sit and double check resources. A lot of people don't. It's still the same right. consumption, just from different sources, right? So that's an interesting point. I'd love to see if we could ever get to some sort of understanding at what drives this vitriol between different groups, right? So, yeah, I'm not for any body parts being chopped off. But honestly, what's the extent of it? And like, how often is it done? And, these are important questions, but politically, what do? You just hear both sides, right? This is horrible. It should never be done. It's happening all the time. And the other side is like, no, it doesn't happen all the time. But I don't know which one is right. And obviously my opinion might be based on that actual fact, right? So interesting stuff. And, but I do appreciate that you're out there actually trying to because a lot of the problems with the Libertarian Party in particular, and libertarians and liberty people, and by the way, the same goes for the Greens, and the same thing goes for the communists in this country, right? More often than not, you're focused on the top level, the presidency, a Senate, a state, not a state senator, but a U.S. senator or a congressman even. But I like your approach. It's like, hey, we're going for state houses. We're going for the local water commissioners or right. whatever. And obviously so in the four states that you've targeted, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Idaho, and North Dakota, did I get that right?
Very impressed.
Thank you. I try. And at this age, it's hard. Trust me, Cliff, 60-year-old brain does not work the way the 30-year-old brain did. But, where do you see yourself gaining more traction? I mean, I might be tempted to say New Hampshire, but that's also what generates the most noise coming out on this issue, right? Is New Hampshire. Like, how are you doing in the other three states? But Pennsylvania mentioned minority Republican Party, so it's tougher there. The spend there is tougher. How's North Dakota and Idaho going?
Yeah, Idaho's our top ranked state by far. New okay. Hampshire and North Dakota, I'd probably put tied for second. It doesn't mean we're targeting them differently. My New Hampshire folks will go nuts. Why did you say right. that? It's right, no, right, listen, right, right. New Hampshire, you don't have to just win the primary for governor. You have to win the general. And that's going to be a battle this right. cycle for Kelly Ayotte versus the Democrat. And I'm not here to say that, like that we're taking a position on that race. We're really focused on state house, because we want to maintain, we have a one seat majority in the House, but the speaker and majority leader are great allies of ours, right? So we're trying to hold that. We're trying to keep that as something that is
right.
a liberty person in charge. Idaho, my wife and I joke about this all the time, but like, I think that's where I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. We're going to probably move there at some point. Now she's active duty Air Force, so we're kind of all over, But when she gets out, I mean, you know, I see Idaho as one of the best opportunities, and here's why. We're making great inroads in the House and Senate, got a lot of great patriots. The battles on the ground are all primaries, right? It's a very red state. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have, it's not just rhinos. You have Democrats who literally run as Republicans,
Sure.
right? Because you have to. And so the battle is the primary, but once you win the primary in a lot of the districts, it's over. The governorship, you win the Republican primary, it's over. And the governor, the previous governor, Brad Little, I think he spent about $2 million to get elected. That's it. Now, I'm not saying that's a drop in the bucket, but compared to
Oh,
Pennsylvania,
sure. Yeah, comparatively
compared to New
speaking,
Hampshire,
yeah,
New
you're
Hampshire,
right. You're right.
they're going to spend $10 million each in the general. So when I look at, hey, where is the best chance for us to check all three boxes for this Liberty State project? Idaho is where I see the most potential. North Dakota has a great demographic in terms of the same thing with the red state. We've got to
Right.
develop some talent there. We've got to really get into recruiting a little bit better. But I look at Idaho as number one for most likely. I put number two tie between North Dakota and New Hampshire. And then Pennsylvania, you know, we're rebuilding, right? We're trying to pick the
Right.
battles that make sense. It is a swing state, so there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of competition. But this cycle, I'll be honest with you, John, running this ballot chase, it's funny because a lot of media, and I'm not putting you in this bucket, but a lot of media typically don't care about a bunch of Liberty folks doing state house races.
Right,
But all of
right.
a sudden, we can impact through our work on the ground, we can impact top of ticket in the swing state that will decide the White House. Hey, Cliff, we want to talk to you. Hey, can you comment? Share your data with us. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, and look, sometimes that's all it takes, right? Is it, you either through serendipity, hard work, or a combination of both. Yeah, you find yourself in the position where you can make a difference, and even the legacy media has no choice but to cover you. Even if you know it's negative coverage coming your way, you know, you can, you know, a seasoned pro like yourself can handle that and take advantage of it, hopefully, to further your agenda. So I totally understand that. I'm glad to hear that you're making inroads in a lot of these states where, in the four states that you mentioned, that, you know, I'm glad to hear that because look, I'm the first to say I'm not like an anarchist. I'm not an ANCAP, right? I don't believe in the right-left libertarian paradigm. I just don't believe in that. So I may not be the libertarian that like a Kaufman or a Heiss will look at and say that's the type of guy we want as part of our movement. I mean I get that. But I think sort of like the fault of that position is. You're in the minority of a minority party if you hold that position, right? So, right? Because, like, listen, you talk to someone like, who did I interview who's like OG, like Walter Block, right? You talk to Walter Block, who's like an OG anarchist, you know, and all that. And I asked him, I said, honestly, Walter, what kind of representation do you have? And he kind of laughed and he gave me that Brooklyn, New York sort of like, Big John, you know. And he's like, we're 1% of whatever percentage the libertarians are in this country, you know. So he goes, do we have a PR problem? Yeah, nobody knows who we are, you know. And I mean, I kind of had a chuckle, not necessarily at Walter, but at sort of his like such plain, straight to the point assessment of if you're all the way in spouting that sort of political agenda, you're really not making a difference. You know what I mean? You're making a ruckus, but you're not making a difference. Whereas I'm talking to you, and it's clear you have a plan. You're not pie in the sky. And yes, it might be aspirational what you hope to achieve, but you're marching towards it in a logical way, which I appreciate. Your math background probably helps with that. And you're like, look, man, you know, I've got four states on my radar. One of them probably because it's your home state and you have some affinity towards it. Like I'm sure if you started from scratch, you may not have picked Pennsylvania, right? But that's okay too. But it's very interesting to me, and I do appreciate that you've put this plan together and that you're out here talking to me and anybody else. You're willing to explain yourself and explain your positions and your philosophy, and I think that is something. To be proud of, you know,
And John, let me make one quick comment because I think I like to give this advice. Now I'm 33 years old, so anybody older than me that's listening, don't take offense to this, but in the last 10 years, I have really found one of the epidemics with any non-mainstream party, you know, independent.
Sure.
The epidemic I find is it's not that there is, it's not that there's a lack of interest or that the ideas are wrong. There's no plan, number one. And number two, there's no money, right? Now, I come
right.
from suburbs of Philadelphia, blue collar working family. And I get in some of these rooms with these political gurus and all these strategists. And I learned very early on, it's great to have an idea, but if you can't fund it, it's like having a car with no gas.
Oh,
right.
Sure.
And the other
yeah.
thing that really frustrates me, and I'm sharing my lessons so people can learn it in 30 seconds rather than banging your head against the wall for a half a decade. You have to be able to fund it, but you also have to be able to measure your results. Right.
Yes.
If I said to you, I'm trying to create a liberty state, but I didn't say what my threshold was of 25% in each chamber and a liberty governor, you know, for 10 years, I could keep going back to donors and activists and volunteers and politicians and say, hey, we're working on it. And I realized after Rand Paul's 2016 Senate race, the power of winning, right? Because we had like 200
right.
people on the ground just volunteering for Rand that we helped. We called it Rand Slide in 2016. He was going to win. He was going to win by 8-9 points, ended up winning by double digits.
Right.
But that night on election night, seeing the faces of all the volunteers who were just lit up with energy, we just won. And I think that that is such a lesson I learned. You have to pick battles you can win. You have to pick battles you can fund. And you have to pick battles you can measure. Not for your sake, if you're trying to be a strategist or somebody that has a plan, but for the sake of the donors, the sake of the activists, the sake of the people that put their name on the ballot. You get defeated if you continuously lose. So I love Walter, but being the 1% of the minority, people get burned out. And I don't mean
sure.
to compromise to win, but I just share that with people. Be able to raise the money, have a plan, be able to measure it, and make sure you can win. That is one of the biggest things I tell new people who are trying to advance the cause.
Yeah, and actually I like, because I heard a lot of what I tell my clients that I consult for when they ask me to measure their programs or their goals, you know, yeah, it has to be SMART goals, SMART KPIs, you know, defined outcomes, defined goals, KPIs that you can measure at regular intervals, and there's not going to be any quibbling. We either make it or we don't, and then we analyze why we made it or we didn't. You're absolutely right. You're taking a very much an analyst's approach, a data scientist approach combined with the strategy. So I do appreciate that you're on this, what seems to be a very measurable path and a very outcome oriented path, while trying to maintain as much of the ideological purity that you hold. I totally see that in talking to you, or I understand that in talking to you right now. And again, I think that's something successful or not, whether you make it across the finish line or not. And I hope you do. But you are giving yourself the highest probability of success by approaching it the way you are. And hopefully we'll see some positive outcomes for the Pennsylvania Chase and your liberty objectives in general. All right. Cliff Maloney, thank you for joining me on the Big Questions with Big John. But before we end, it is now time for a segment I call Silly Questions. These are going to be five questions that have absolutely nothing to do with anything other than letting folks hopefully get a little bit more of an understanding of who Cliff Maloney Jr. is. All right, question number one. Which historical liberty figure would you invite to karaoke night, and what song would you make that person sing?
Thomas Jefferson. And I'd probably make him sing Meatloaf, like a bat out of hell.
Interesting. Interesting.
Why you didn't expect that from a third.
You know, Thomas Jefferson, I fully accept. Bat out of hell. Explain to me, why bat out of hell for Mr. Jefferson?
You know, I just think... I was thinking, what's the last thing he'd sing? And I think that might be it. Have some
okay,
fun at karaoke.
Enough.
A couple beers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Which political movement will most likely achieve its goals in your lifetime, Cliff? Not mine, because mine's coming to an end soon, probably. Antifa or the Free State Project?
Wow, I'm usually an optimist. I will say Antifa.
And is it
Doesn't mean
because
I'm
you
not
feel
gonna fight like hell to ruin that,
right?
but I think the reality is, I think this election will tell us, you know, how much is public perception of what's acceptable and not. And I think we have a lot of work to do. And I think what's more difficult for us is we're not offering anything in terms of handouts, right? There's no lobbyists coming to our door offering us things. All my money comes from grassroots patriots that believe in the Constitution. And I worry when that scale will tip a little too much. So I'd like to think it's the Free State Project. I'm working towards that. But I think Antifa will succeed in certain states way before we're able. I think they have already. I mean, they've taken over some of these states.
Thank you for your honesty on that one, and for that assessment as well. Okay, what's your favorite sport and what's your favorite team? I think I know the answer because I saw you drinking out of your coffee mug, but I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, I am a huge Eagles fan, die hard, but I actually would say the Phillies. You know, I'm a baseball guy. Played football, played baseball, but I do love the Phillies. It's tough to keep up, you know, with travel as much as I do, 162 games a year. Eagles are a little easier to follow. I can try to get to three or four games, but now definitely the Phillies is my diehard team.
See, now we may have set ourselves up to be mortal enemies because I'm a
You a
Giants and
Mets
Mets
guy?
fan.
I figured.
Growing up, even though I grew up in the shadow of Yankee Stadium, I have to admit to being a Mets fan because my favorite player growing up was Tom Seaver. So I grew up a Mets fan in the shadow of Yankee Stadium, which did not bode well for me walking home from school. But it's good to know.
You
Okay,
guys
Phillies
got
and
the best of
Eagles.
us. You got the best of us last night, so you got the W
Yeah,
currently.
that's true. That's true. Short-lived, but I'll take it. What's your go-to analogy to explain liberty concepts to children? Or young, let me change that to young people.
Some people make things happen. Some people wonder what happened. And most people in America never know anything ever happened at all. I like to explain that and really, you know, try to, when I'm teaching young people, it's, there's a very rare few, you know, you can compare that to the founders, right? You can compare
Sure.
that to different people who actually said, you know, it wasn't this majority. But it really is, you know, it's the work of the activists behind an ideology and who is the most efficient, who's the most effective, who's the most impactful. And so I always tell people that, you know, the vast majority of people you know in your life have no idea what the Federal Reserve is doing. They have no idea,
Right.
you know, what is causing inflation and the overspending in Congress. They just don't. They don't understand the spying. They don't understand the DOJ, the FBI, and some of the weaponization. There are a few people who wonder what happened. They had battle plans that weren't really built. They had battle plans that weren't funded. They weren't measured. But I really encourage people to be those folks that make things happen. And that to me is kind of the objective for anybody who wants to be effective.
Fair enough. And last silly question, what's your guilty pleasure when it comes to unwinding after a long campaign?
I do love to play poker. I try to get out to the World Series of Poker once a year out in Vegas, play a couple of those tournaments. I am a recreational player, so I'm very much outgunned. But 2022, I made day five of the World Series of Poker main event. So there were 8,600 players. I ended up finishing around 200th. So that was a fun one. And I have won a World Poker Tour event with about 600 players back that same year. So I've had some fun, but that's my way to unwind is to focus on the math and put my poker face on.
See, I was going to say that's a perfect leisure time activity because it still keeps the mathematical mind sharp. I saw
Right.
the tie-in there, and I was just about to say good recreational time. All right, Cliff Maloney, thank you for joining us. Please let everyone know, plug whatever you have, X handle, website. Please feel free. Go
Sure.
ahead.
Yeah, I'm on X at Maloney, just my last name at Maloney. And look, if people want to help right now, we've got 120 full-time ballot chasers on the ground for the PA chase. It's $175 for a full day sponsorship that covers their pay, their housing, and their gas. 100% of that goes to the ballot chaser. That's at pachase.com. $175 for a full day. Let's advance the cause of liberty. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, Cliff, thank you for joining us. And to everyone out there, you have been watching The Big Questions with Big John right here on Grumblings Media. You can catch us on YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, basically anywhere you feel like catching a podcast. We're there. Until next time, when we'll have yet another interesting guest here on the show. This is Big John. Peace, everyone.